Welcome to Super Context, a podcast autopsy of media.
How we consume it and how it informs our everyday culture.
I'm Christian Sager, a writer and a designer.
And I'm Charlie Bennett, a librarian and a radio raconteur.
Each episode is us trying to understand the entertainment world that we all live in.
Just a little bit better.
Today's episode is about Trout Mask Replica by Captain Beefheart and his magic band. This 1969 double album has been described as both unlistenable and one of the greatest albums of all time. We discuss its volatile production while trying to understand its composition and how it influenced another 50 years of weird music.
You can find our sources at patreon.com/supercontext, where you can leave us a comment or send us an email at supercontextpodcast@gmail.com. Do you like Trout Mask Replica? Have you ever heard it? Chris, before the show starts, I think we should take care of some business.
I think we should too. So, listeners, we have decided that after 4 full years of doing this show, we're going to retire regular episodes of Super Context in May of 2020.
We're letting you know here because our Patreon supporters already have heard from us, and we've had discussions on the Patreon page, patreon.com/supercontext, but we don't want this to be a surprise to any of our regular listeners. So this is just to let you know. The next few months, we're going to hit as many of the gotta do it subjects as we can before we cease production probably mid-May of this year.
Yeah, we wanted to give everybody a heads up before the show ended. So we've got 5 more months of episodes. By my count, that's almost 20 episodes before we retire the show. Look, I just want to say that doing the show has been really rewarding, especially being able to expand it by having a patron. But unfortunately, the production schedule has just been unsustainable for the two of us. We've got things to maintain due to our day jobs, our families, and all of our other creative projects. If you want more information about what we're going to do with the show after May, keep listening to the episode, and at the Patreon spot in the middle, we'll throw down some more information.
Chris, do you find that you enjoy difficult music?
You know, I think about this a lot in relation to the kind of music that I'm into, and I think there's a difference between quote, difficult music or like complex music and what some people call, I hate this term, but some people call extreme music.
Yes, those are two very different things.
And I think I'm interested in all of the above, but that I lean more into the extreme category than the difficult category. So I only have a certain amount of patience for a lot of noodling or kind of showing off between instruments. Stuff like that. I guess what you would probably call prog rock. I have limited patience for that. This record, maybe not this record, but this band strikes an interesting middle ground for me because it's both difficult and extreme. Somehow the two cancel each other out for me, and it doesn't bother me the way it bothers other people.
Yeah. And if we did a taxonomy of all the ways that you could categorize music like this, I feel like you'd have to pull apart extreme and challenging. Right? Challenging to listen to versus extreme in effect, I guess, or extreme in technical ability.
Or tone or atonal or just the like the way in which sounds are combined on this record. There's a lot that is extreme in the sense that like it's taken further than it ever would be on like a quote mainstream musical composition.
Yeah. I remember the first time someone told me that the band Yes was boring, which was really strange to me because it's, I mean, I like that band. I love that band. I don't see it being boring. I can understand people not enjoying the music, but why would it ever be boring? And that was like this twist of the glasses that I then went, you know, my ear goggles, and I went back and listened to it. I'm like, oh yeah, if you didn't care about a couple aspects mm-hmm. of this music, it's incredibly boring.
Yep.
If you're like, I'm waiting for a groove, or, you know, he's not singing about anything except hobbits, and not even that, you know. And that was, I think, my introduction to the non-monolithic difficulty of music, the compartmentalized difficulty of music, where some people don't like content, some people don't like or instrumentation, some people don't like the arrangement, some people don't like the composition, and that's not going to be the same in each piece.
I mean, I can absolutely see why people would say that about Yes. I could also see why people would say it about this, although this is where I think like the extreme quality takes us to a different level, right? Because in some senses, once you get past the first like 10 seconds of them all playing something different, it is kind of boring, but it's also so extreme that it like it doesn't allow you to divert your attention away from it.
Yeah, and it starts to take on the responsibility of art, in that it challenges your perspective and makes you have to pay attention. It requires attention because there's no safe sort of retread or remix to land on in your apprehension of it.
That's an interesting way to approach it, because I think one question a lot of people ask is, what is the value of Captain Beefheart and his magical band, you know, beyond the sort of mathematics, you know, like sitting down with a piece of paper and figuring out all of the time signatures and everything. There's a lot of people who are like, this is unlistenable. That comes up many times in the research. But also, even people who unpack it and go, okay, I get it now. I get what they're doing, but why?
Yes. So I had the weird experience of, and I assume you did too, having done Batman Odyssey and then Ravenous and then Trout Mask Replica. So with Batman Odyssey, a whole bunch of people took on a work and said, I don't understand it. It's so crazy. It makes no sense. And you and I then talked about how, no, it's not that it doesn't make any sense. It's that there's this particular thread that was different than what people expected. But
it's actually kind of similar to this, because like it's using the language of its medium in an incomprehensible way.
Yeah. And then Ravenous, which was like a genre piece that snuck commentary and politics in, by the extremity of its genre. And it's almost like my brain now really wants Trout Mask Replica to be the synthesis of the thesis and antithesis of Batman Odyssey and Ravenous.
I don't really feel that same pull. Yeah, I was going to say, I'm wondering if we're going to get to the end of this episode and you're going to be satisfied in that respect, but...
Oh, well, that particular thing, no. But I'm also prepared to not be satisfied in that.
I think like many of the topics like this that we approach, it is unfortunate that the revelation, spoilers for what's coming up in the episode, that the main person behind this was kind of full of shit and was a jerk to the other people that he worked with and the people who did the bulk of the work in making this what it was. So that's disappointing, but also part of the super context of, you know, understanding the whole thing, that it is literally, once again, a moment in music where the musician creates a narrative about themselves and perpetuates that almost more than the actual music.
Yeah.
Like spends more time on that.
When you get into the way that the record was composed and rehearsed and played, you realize, oh, it's not his magic band. Captain Beefheart and a band were locked in a kind of combat, an artistic combat. And from that came this extraordinary work, which he then took ownership of.
Yeah. And so like for my own part, you know, I've been listening to Beefheart casually for, I don't know, a little over 15 years. and I'm not like so hardcore into it. I have all the records and I sit there and analyze the time signatures or anything like that. I just kind of enjoy putting it on every once in a while. But I'm sort of embarrassed because I always assumed just from the liner notes and the records that I had, like, okay, so this guy was the driving force and he did everything. And then he just had backup players who did stuff. And it's not, that's not the case, but that's what he wants you to believe.
Yes. Let us once again kill the idea of the lone genius.
Right. Yeah. So we are talking about the infamous Trout Mask Replica album. This is the third studio album by Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band. This album was released in 1969. There are a lot of legends about it. We are going to try to cut through the bullshit to get to the heart of what actually did happen. Because, frankly, Captain Beefheart himself purposely put out disinformation about the record so that he could try to maintain control over the property.
And we're lucky for our purposes that a big anniversary, a 50-year anniversary hit, and a lot of people dug in and pulled out stories and synthesized them and kind of gave us the material that we needed to do our thing.
Yeah, and I think, too, that the other thing that's fascinating about this episode is almost all of the firsthand information comes from the drummer of the band, not Beefheart himself. There's a little bit of information from other members of the band, but John French is like the guy who has gone out in public and been like, no, this is all bullshit. Here's what actually happened.
Okay, let's try and explain what the bullshit is before we dispel it. Well, to introduce Trout Mask Replica, if you have not heard it before, let's first quote Rolling Stone. This is David Frick writing about it. 50 years on, nearly a decade after Captain Beefheart's death, Trout Mask Replica remains one of the ultimate tests of how far you are willing to go to give yourself up to music. It is not the first Captain Beefheart record you should hear, but you should not miss it. At the very least, you will not be bored.
I'll tell you, the very first time I ever heard about Captain Beefheart was in the mid-90s when Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love were still married and he was still alive. And they said something, one of them said something in an interview that they, I think they like were like, oh yeah, we conceived our child to Trout Mask Replica or one of the other records. And I was like, huh, what's that?
It is unlikely to start with. Yeah. First time I ever heard Beefheart was his guest vocals on Bongo Fury by Frank Zappa. Nope, that's not right. Hot Rats. Sorry, his guest vocals on Hot Rats. Because I was a Zappa head, and I was listening to what I heard was a jazz rock fusion album, and then all of a sudden there's this guy yelling at me. And so I came to Captain Beefheart through the self-aggrandizing legend making of Frank Zappa,
where you can see where he picked this up from. Yeah. Beefheart. So let's get into who Beefheart was, and he's since passed away, but this is a short little bio about him that we'll pull from. So for this record, let's clarify, his role on this record was that he was the singer and he played brass and woodwind instruments, but he also, in quotes, composed the music.
He is the sole lyricist.
Yeah.
And then he is credited as writing the songs. Although yeah, that, it's, and we're going to get deep into what yeah, writing the songs actually required.
Yeah. But so his real name is Don Van Vliet. Is that how you say it? Vliet?
I've always Vliet? Said Van Vliet.
Van Vliet.
Okay. Americanized it. But yeah, V-L-I-E-T.
Okay. He was born in 1941 in California. One thing that we know is that he went to high school with Frank Zappa. So that's kind of how he got involved in all of this stuff. He did two records with the Magic Band that, quote, drew positive notice from connoisseurs, but failed to connect with the wider public. Zappa subsequently signed Beefheart to a label called Straight Records. And that's where this record came from.
Yeah. Frank Zappa is the actual producer of Trout Mask Replica.
Yeah. And this is the description of Trout Mask Replica in the bio. This bizarre double album was not a major commercial success, but it quickly became a cultural landmark. Van Vliet effectively redefined the frontiers of popular music, singing snatches of surreal imagery in disturbing tones over music that drew on blues, jazz, psychedelia, and a thousand other subgenres. It is still cited today as an essential art rock document. And so basically, like, he played with this band, but it was like rotating members. Like, it was, I don't think there were any like single consistent members of the Magic Band throughout the entire tenure other than him, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that their treatment during the recording of Trout Mask Replica cracked their loyalty, if nothing else.
Yeah, some people came and went, and as we'll learn, they started performing without him as well. And then in later years, this is sort of the legend of him, is like he became a hermit and he just like went off into the desert and was a painter. And his paintings were apparently pretty successful. In fact, one of them was reportedly offered at the asking price of $40,000.
I've seen Beefheart be described in his early life as a very accomplished sculptor. Like, he started as a artist, self-taught, and then also semi-trained in some areas.
Yeah.
But his success as Captain Beefheart as a musician is completely untrained. This is just what he dug into.
Reading about him and how he got to where he was reminds me a lot of the biography that I'm reading on S. Clay Wilson that I've told you about.
Yeah.
S. Clay Wilson was an underground cartoonist in the 60s. And their trajectories are very similar. I think it's just like there were only so many options for like art student quasi hippie punks at that time. You know, they didn't quite fit in with either. Well, punk didn't even exist yet, but they didn't quite fit in even with the alternative sub communities. And so they have, yeah, both of these guys seem to have these weird trajectories that produced this incredibly odd art that we look back on now and go like, oh my word, where did that come from?
Yeah. Trout Mask Replica sounds the way that Gravity's Rainbow reads.
You think?
I do.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see some of that. There's some of the same like tongue in cheek stuff too.
Yep. Multiple flashbacks. You know, if you want to try and what's the literary equivalent of shifting time signatures and polyrhythms, it's flashbacks within flash forwards within flashbacks.
So I think that's an interesting comparison because I think the same kind of people who would hate reading a Thomas Pynchon novel would probably hate listening to a Captain Beefheart record.
Most likely.
And vice versa, the same kind of people who really enjoy either of these things, I think, in some ways, when they first come to it, are looking for something that's purposely challenging, that they can be like, this sets me apart from others because I'm able to withstand this. You know, yeah. I'm able to get through 50 pages, or I'm able to listen to the first side of Trout Mask.
Trout Mask Replica is so aggressively weird that it does seem like you have to decide to get into it.
Yeah, for sure. And I have theories. I have theories about the type of people who do and how that relates to Beefheart himself and sort of his persona. But I don't know if I want to share them on here. We'll see how far we get. It seems very clear that he was a difficult person. And it also seems to me that people who are difficult themselves are attracted to this, that they're like, oh yeah. Yeah. I get it, man. I'm right in there in the zone with you.
Sounds like you've shared your theory, Chris.
There's probably more to it than that, but anyways, let's, speak to John French, who was the drummer on this record. Really did a lot more than drumming. He was pretty much the actual composer of this record.
Yeah, the composer arranger of, you know, from the demos that Captain Beefheart improvised at him.
So he talks about Don sort of biographically as such. He says, Don was the initial creative force in the band. There's no denying that. Lyrically, he is unsurpassed. Musically, however, He was not very organized, nor did he at all understand the extreme learning curve that it took to actually bring his vision to life. As a result, the band members, some more than others, contributed a great deal more to the actual completion and arranging of the music than even he ever realized. If anyone ever mentioned this, his extreme reaction was to say something to the effect of, "Oh, so now you're saying that you wrote the music?" Which, of course, wasn't the case. And French goes on to mention that the atmosphere that developed from the insane recording practice was one of tolerance on the band's part, to take a submissive role of appearing to just be a group of trained monkeys with absolutely no creative ability. He says, "Look, I know I'm exaggerating, but that is how it appeared from the inside. The public was not interested in us, because Don portrayed us as not being very interesting or relevant. Therefore, our careers suffered because we had almost no recognition except with hardcore fans, and then only because we were associated with Van Vliet. Frankly, Don really never seemed to appreciate the band members. He often told me that he, quote, hated musicians. He also had a kind of Jekyll and Hyde mannerism in which he would befriend the musicians one-on-one, and then in a group atmosphere, he would verbally abuse and humiliate them. It was part of the price that was paid for being a Magic Band member and was very unpleasant for all involved in the earlier bands."
So this makes me think of David Fincher talking about directing a movie. He said, it's kind of like shouting instructions on how to paint a painting from 100 yards away while six other people hold a brush and try to move it the way you want it. And so he, you know, described that as this is the team you have to lead and the levels that your vision has to go through before it's realized.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is not what we understand bands to be like, you know, especially rock bands that, you know, post Beatles rock bands.
Mm-hmm.
But Captain Beefheart essentially tried to declare himself an auteur, you know, who was running a very complicated art project, using musicians to create his vision.
Yeah.
When actually it was a very charismatic and manipulative artist who decided to start doing blues music or music just generally without training, who exploited the musical knowledge of his bandmates to make it seem like he was crafting an entire experience all by himself.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll see this later on in the notes, but many of the members refer to it as having a cult-like atmosphere and that he treated it as such. One thing interesting in relation to that is that he insisted on using pseudonyms for all the musicians, which I think is somewhat early in the canon of rock and roll for this kind of thing. It's kind of fascinating. He says, so we'll go through each band member, but like these are the names that he gave them: Zoot Horn Rollo, Rockette Morton, Antenna Jimmy Siemens, the Mascara Snake, and then Drumbo. Now, Drumbo is French, who we've already heard from, and apparently his credits were dropped entirely from this record. In the original pressings, because they had conflicts, the two of them, and this resulted in the drummer briefly leaving the group.
Yeah, John French said that he was probably the youngest of the group, or at least he was the least aggressive of the group, and so he took the brunt of the kind of manipulative, cult-like behavior. So here we go. Let's go back to David Frick real quick and try and explain what it is that we're saying about Beefheart and his control over the band. They lived together and rehearsed at a house in Los Angeles on the edge of starvation as French transcribed the raw data of Van Vliet's composing, whistling ideas and banging on a piano, an instrument he could not actually play, and the band forged the fragments into angular episodic sense.
Yeah, that's like the legend is like he wrote everything on piano, but he didn't know how to play piano. So he would sit there and like fumble on the keys, playing what he wanted parts to sound like. Then French would take that to the bassist or the guitar player or whatever, and they would compose something out of this pretty amateur performance.
French, as a drummer, had the best sense of how to get the time signature out of each of these weird moments. You know, I remember one time playing in a band. We recorded a demo without the drummer. And when he came in to then like write his drum part, he said, "Did you guys know that you wrote the chorus in 15/16? We're like, "What?" And without the drummer there, we just like felt it, big quote marks, felt it. And we dropped a beat out of the chorus that we shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so Beefheart was the ultimate version of that. He just wanted it to sound a certain way. And he had no idea what that actual musical theory was behind it.
So let's go through each band member. And then if we have information about them or quotes from them about this record and how it was made, we'll turn to those. Honestly, there's some of these people who just haven't really spoken out about this. We'll start with Bill Harkleroad, who is one of the guitar players. There was an interview with John French that we're going to consult at length. And apparently Bill Harkleroad wrote a book about this experience. Now, I didn't have access to that for the research here. But he claims in his book that at various times, he, John French, and Mark Boston, who were all in the band, physically came to blows. And so he asked, this interviewer asks French, like, "Is that true? And, you know, can you speak to why that was happening?" French basically says that when Don wasn't around, everybody got along well. Apparently, the three of them were all childhood friends, knew each other, had played music together before hooking up with Beefheart. And they hadn't really had major conflicts before that. But then, under the conditions of making this record, French says, quote, "It is true that physical violence reared its ugly head several times during our tenure together. Bill told me that while writing his book, he once had to run outside and collapse on his lawn, vomiting from reliving the trauma of recording this record."
This is a band living together in a house for, you know, a good part of a year, and in some way falling into kind of a fugue-like relationship with each other, because they were doing all the things that you hear about in California. They were doing drugs and doing weird diets and being freaks just generally. And then Beefheart was taking advantage of that in some way. There was an interview with Beefheart where someone said, you know, "How did you teach the musicians the parts on this record?" And he said, "With a whip."
Oh yeah, I saw that.
No, not a whip. You know, with the quip. And he just started futzing around with language.
Yeah, yeah.
Never acknowledged they taught me the parts. You know, never acknowledged that I made the sounds and they translated them.
Mm-hmm. The other guitar player was John Cotton. And honestly, there wasn't a whole lot from him about his involvement in this record. He seems to have been pretty quiet. Mark Boston is one of the guys that we just referred to. This is Rocket Morton is his Beefheart TN name. this is another reference from John French. He says, "Boston is the only bass player I know of who actually finger picks and plays chords on the bass. It's a very unique style, and he developed it while working on Trout Mask Replica." This guy went on to play on a bunch of other Beefheart records, but just other records in general. And he and Harkleroad played in a band called Mallard in 1975, and they recorded two records together.
So John French, the drummer that we're relying on in this episode, he joined the band in 1966, and he was in the band for 14 years with a few dropouts. Like, he was driven to leave the band at the end of the Trout Mask Replica.
Yeah, recording. He says he played with Don for 7 years over a 14-year period. So he was kind of like in and out. Yeah,
big chunks of not being part of the band. But he said, "My early tenure in the band gave me a unique opportunity to explore and develop drum patterns because of the extreme originality of the music." And I think in there is the kind of hint as to why would anyone put up with this kind of haunted house that we're describing, they were doing a remarkable art project, and a bunch of trained musicians were being given these remarkable problems by a person who was composing in an erratic and an untrained way.
Yeah, one of the sources that we have for this episode is a Vox video presentation. They do kind of a deep dive where they interview multiple composers, but also John French. And French says in that video, sometimes I wondered if he knew that these parts were in different time signatures, but then I realized he didn't know what a time signature was. And so this is sort of how he understands Beefheart, you know, in retrospect now.
Yeah. And so French diagnoses Beefheart as someone trying to maintain control. And I think that control probably comes from making sure that no one could be more important or become a leader of the band through musical knowledge.
Before we get into a long run of John French quotes, because he's got a lot to say, I do want to mention we skipped one band member. Victor Hayden played the bass clarinet on this record. But again, there isn't like a ton about Hayden and his contributions. Okay, so here we go. Let's get into this French stuff, because he's done a lot of interviews and he's been very straightforward and honest about the experience.
He's been working out this experience in public for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So he says, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind, and never has been, that the toxic atmosphere of recording this record was manufactured by Van Vliet. I didn't understand what his motivation was back then. Now, I interpret it as one of the methods that he used to control us. I'm sure he viewed our comradeship as a threat to his leadership. So he felt he had to keep us compartmentalized by nurturing hostility. And he did this by betraying confidence. So I'll summarize the next part, which is essentially one person in the band would say something to Beefheart in private, and then Beefheart would bring it up in front of the entire group of people, revealing these resentments that they had about one another, sort of positioning himself as the guru who was set aside from it all and letting them fight it out.
Yeah, French calls it brainwashing combined with a very bad form of group therapy.
The interviewer asks, do you think this tension actually helped at all? And I think this is where French really throws down the like thesis of this record. He says, some people have the theory that these records could not have been made without the psychological trauma that was being inflicted upon the players. My thought is that the music would have been far better performed in less time and with wider appeal if Don had allowed the group to have some credit for our contribution and given us the ability to express ourselves musically a bit with gentle guidance instead of fierce oppression. So it's interesting, like, what would this record have sounded like if it was a more collaborative effort?
Yeah. And French also mentions that the band began as a blues band, a slightly weird, a California weird blues band. And that's like Safe as Milk.
That's the first record, right?
Yeah.
Or second record.
And then it progressed on an avant-garde path to get to Trout Mask Replica. And an interviewer said, were you interested in this progression from, you know, a band of a bunch of guys who like the Yardbirds connecting with a weird enough frontman to kind of stand out? And French says, it was farther than I personally cared to go at the time, as I knew it was a financial mistake to go that far out. And I wanted to make money and help my family. The interviewer then says, at any time, did it become more of a job than a mission? And French says, Don's writing, Captain Beefheart's writing, left a lot of unanswered questions when putting together the arrangements. At a certain point during the creation of Trout Mask, it became clear to me that I was going to be sitting at the piano more than playing the drums. My drum playing was better when I was younger because I could practice instead of this period of time, he says, when he wasn't really doing any drumming. Add to this the cult-like atmosphere and the sheer volume of work, and these factors contributed to making my role seem rather job-like at times.
So I want to pause for a second and just throw this out there. Reading all of this from him, and then we hear a little bit more from like Harkle Road and other people down the line, makes me far less interested in this record. And maybe the entire Beefheart project as a whole, because it really sounds unpleasant, and it sounds like people gave a lot of negative parts of their life to like bring this thing together and to put this out in the world. And I'm not entirely sure it was worth it. This is a fun record and it's cool to analyze, and we'll get into that stuff later. But there's a big part of me that after reading all of this is like, it makes me feel icky. Like I don't want to be involved in this anymore.
I do want us to remember that we hear Trout Mask Replica now in the post Trout Mask Replica universe. You know, people point to this as being a very important record because nothing sounded like this when it came out.
And it did. No matter how important it was it worth these people feeling as bad as they did to make it?
Well, I'm not ready to answer that yet.
Yeah.
I mean, I just want to say Trout Mask Replica is a version of the first Velvet Underground album. You know, it made it into the world and its influence is big enough that it actually is hard to take away from our understanding of music.
Yeah. It's kind of fascinating because we'll get into this later on. There's several composers and I guess like music theorists who comment on this record and why it's so important. And they're really fascinated with it. And not once do they mention any of this stuff that we're talking about here, how he treated the other band members, how they felt, the circumstances. They almost treat it as if it's like this alien object that just kind of came into being on its own.
Yeah, and that's what it was sold as in a lot of ways. Like, hey, here's the inside of Captain Beefheart's head.
Yeah, yeah. So French continues, and he said, when Don would write the music, it left a lot of unanswered questions putting together the arrangements. My interest was basically maintained by the fact that the idea of putting together music that was breaking so many conventional rules posed an interesting challenge. And despite of all of Don's interviews where he claimed the total creation was his, I also enjoyed writing many of my own drum parts.
You know, this just pops into my head when you read that. I don't know why. I think a better way to say what I was saying about Trout Mask Replica and its influence is sort of like you have to treat it like a relationship that ultimately you ended because you had to be out of it. And yet whatever you did in that time when you were with a person is still part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because certainly John French is very clear that it was a bad scene, but also saying that thing about it's an interesting challenge. I enjoyed writing many of my own drum parts.
Yeah.
He connected with Frank Zappa, who was, you know, an actual composer and could write music. He was young enough that he was learning all this stuff. And then he says, you know, I love the idea of going on stage and playing this strange music for the general public just to see their reaction. It was still a useful artistic venture for the band. It could have been a lot better if Beefheart hadn't been as twisted, I guess, as he was.
He also comments on the actual studio recording process, which we'll get into a little bit more later, but notoriously, they practiced this record for like 8 months, and then they went into the studio and recorded it in like 6 hours or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, I really would have liked it if we could have spent a week in the studio, because when you listen to the actual recording, the guitars are out of tune. The endings weren't played correctly. The first concept you have of something that generally sticks with you, and the album that you hear is a rough sketch of what it actually could have been. If memory serves, Don had a week to do his vocals. I think we should have also had that long just to sort out the technical problems.
So Zappa scheduled a week to record, and that was, some of the band members say, that seemed kind of like an on-purpose limitation of the time for us to play.
Yeah, we'll talk about this when we get to the label information later, but there seems to be a push and pull of Zappa and the band going on, in which he had pledged to record this, produce it, and pay for it and put it out in the world, and yet he also seemed to be trying to cut costs as much as possible.
And then he gave Beefheart the bulk of that time after he got all of the instrumental parts recorded and out of the way. And they say in, you know, 4.5 to 6 hours that really freaked Zappa out because they just got in there and they just did it.
Yeah.
Then Beefheart had a week to sing on top of that, that mess. Meaning, I think that Zappa was more interested in helping Beefheart do his thing than he was in helping the band do their thing.
Well, Beefheart was his client. They weren't.
His buddy, even.
Yeah. You can hear some of this, like, when you look into how this record was made, there's demos that you can hear of them doing the vocal tracks, and it's like, just listening to, like, 30 seconds of them trying to do the vocal tracks makes you want to pull your hair out, because, like, Van Vliet is very controlling about how everything is paced and how everything sounds and how each word is pronounced. Yeah. So he clearly put like a lot more effort into that.
There's that wonderful moment on the record where they're doing the Fast and Bulbous.
That's the section I'm talking about. Yeah.
And, but then he says, no, no, you got to wait until I say, and then in a tin cup, and you hear Mascara Snake say, oh Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm so tired of this.
I'm done with your absurd bullshit. Yeah.
French says, I think Trout Mask would have been taken more seriously right at the start had the recording quality been higher. We were rushed through the session. It would still have its edge, but it would also have a more professional sound. There was a certain satisfaction of seeing Zappa's face when we walked in the control room after having completed all the remaining tracks in 4.5 hours. I think that Frank had set us up with what he considered to be an impossible time constraint. A double album of instrumental tracks in 6 hours was unheard of. We did it in 4.5. Just to say, okay, Frank, you want to play hardball? How's this for efficiency?
Yeah, let's try to boil this down. So it's a double album. It's close to 2 hours long. So that means like they only did one or two takes of each track.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
But they had been practicing for 8 months.
Yeah. Oh, they were on fire. They knew how to do this. Yeah. Okay. Here's some more from French. He's asked about the acclaim that the record receives and whether or not he's upset because he doesn't feel like he gets the recognition that Beefheart does. And he says, look, I actually don't understand this question fully because I don't like the term acclaim and attention. If you're speaking of the attention that I and the rest of the band are now receiving, I'm not sure that I sit around telling myself, oh, finally I'm getting what I deserve. I suppose that I have learned now to accept what I have earned as a result of my former not-so-pleasant experience. My motivation, however, is not to, quote, get what I deserve. It is more a matter of returning with a fresh look to my primary musical roots, which is a familiar place with which I'm extremely familiar. Okay. I want to create an atmosphere for myself and others in which performing the music can be an enjoyable experience rather than a tedious and stressful task. So he's referring to how he and other members of the Beefheart band, of the Magic Band, went on to perform on their own. They did tours of these records without Beefheart. And yeah. I believe French did the vocals when they performed live.
I wish I had seen one of those shows.
It'd probably be pretty interesting. I admire his statement here that he's trying to take a past negative experience and turn it into a present positive experience. I don't know necessarily as a music listener that I would have been as interested in seeing this performed live. Although there is a large part of me that's also kind of like, I don't think I would have wanted to watch Beefheart live. I've seen like videos before and I was kind of like, okay. Like I don't really feel like I missed out on that much.
Yeah. French says his original vision for the reunion, this, you know, anniversary reunion, was based upon his experience of writing track by track notes on the Beefheart CDs, like the re-releases.
And realizing
how much he missed playing the music.
Mm-hmm.
There is a core to all of this. I mean, it's almost like because we've been listening to the music and just thinking, oh, yeah, this is Captain Beefheart's record. Yeah. When you discover, no, he was abusive and manipulative and took a lot of credit for stuff that he didn't do, it kind of shakes out like, oh, no, that this is no longer a fun record. But even the band have pride and satisfaction in this,
in the end result.
Yeah, this extraordinary and difficult artistic achievement.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a little bit more talk about like the atmosphere in which they recorded the record. French says the dread of the cult atmosphere would squeeze me out of the group like toothpaste from a tube. And so this would result in him sometimes quitting the band or getting fired by Van Vliet. He says he wasn't really telling him what he wanted to hear. And in Beefheart's desire for control, I was the square peg that didn't fit in the round hole. What brought me back over and over again was my love of the music. So I think French played on like almost all the records that came out.
Oh yeah. No, he played the record.
Yeah.
He just left almost immediately after.
Yeah.
We've got a lot from French. I want to skip through some of it, but I do want to point out that he said, I heard that Beefheart was grouchy about the reunion. I am absolutely certain that he would not be pleased. However, I'm not doing this for him. And also he talks about the question from the interviewer is, can you easily reconcile in your head that you are now essentially paying high tribute to the music of a man who once apparently threw you down half a flight of stairs? And French says, that may be the way an outsider views it. But to me, I have nothing to reconcile. I'm just going back to my roots. I don't think of this as a tribute to Don, but as a return to my own unique musical identity.
One thing that is pretty interesting is he talks about the experience as if he and Harkleroad both had PTSD afterwards from it.
Yeah.
He says, yeah. I became socially dysfunctional for years after recording this record. I would actually duck when people would, quote, talk with their hands. I think meaning like when they would raise their hands up in conversation, he would be worried they were going to hit him. He says, I became a bit of a hermit. I envisioned myself as completely useless and I often contemplated suicide. So that's the kind of quote where I'm like, I don't know, man, yeah. Was this record worth it?
So much of what comes out of this is that Beefheart mimicked cult experiences, right?
Yeah.
Like violence, brainwashing, you know, keeping people away from their loved ones, you know, keeping them all together and under his physical immediate control.
I believe there was also what we refer to with my dogs as resource guarding.
Yes.
There's a note in here about how the house had a Manson-esque quality to it. The material circumstances were dire. They had no income other than welfare and contributions from relatives. So they survived on a bare subsistence diet. French recounted that they lived on no more than a small cup of soybeans a day for a month. And at one point, the band members were arrested because they shoplifted food, and then Zappa had to go bail them out. They were described as cadaverous and all looking like they were in poor health. My word. It just sounds like a fucking nightmare.
Now, here's the thing that we have to remember. This could not have been the plan. It's not like they all got together and said, okay, let's all get in this house and Beefheart can run it. Mm-hmm. You know, like somehow this happened when a band said, okay, for our next record, let's all get a house together. And, you know, practice it and put it together. You know, Don's got this deal with Frank Zappa that he's going to record the album and he's got complete creative control. So let's do it.
Yeah.
Like somehow this happened. And, you know, part of me thinks of a stereotypical late 60s California as this was the time sort of through osmosis moving into these people's lives.
It could be. Another thing French says is that Van Vliet once admitted to him that he had been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. And so apparently he was seeing, quote, non-existent conspiracies that explained his behavior, the cult-like stuff that was going on inside the house.
Yeah. Beefheart is a very difficult person to reconcile with the enjoyment of the music.
For sure. It's kind of reminding me of the stuff that I've been reading about Rocky Erickson. I got that Rocky Erickson, the Evil One, like super nice deluxe vinyl edition. And it has like a book inside it that has interviews with all the people he grew up with and who played on the records, and describes the process of how that record got made, which was also crazy. Yeah. And sounds very similar. Yeah. Yeah. Another figure like S. Clay Wilson. I think that we're seeing a lot of this, like, white guys in their 20s in the 60s who are like creative and artistic, but just don't know how to express themselves within the channels, I guess, that were available at that time. And so also, it turns into this kind of nightmarish shit.
Yeah, and they're also being given the signals that they should break free of standards and traditions. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the time, like, fight the man, go against the power. And, you know, there are some rules of civilization that are good, right? I really like Zappa, but I also have a streak of hating Frank Zappa, mm-hmm. you know? And I have, like, little bits of information that keep accumulating into my what I don't like about Zappa.
Well, why don't you take this section? Because I know almost nothing about Zappa.
So I don't like his sense of humor at all. It's very hard for me sometimes to enjoy his records because the instrumental stuff is sort of just wiped away by his puerile, childish sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And then also there's a streak of cruelty to him. And that's really clear in the way that he plans to record the album.
This album, Trout Mask Replica. Yeah.
Yeah. Because after all that stuff we talked about, that this was what the house was like, a Manson-like house with cadaverous and unhealthy musicians practicing together, Frank Zappa originally proposed to record the album as a ethnic field recording. That's in quotes.
I feel like that's the wrong terminology. I think what he meant was an ethnographic field recording.
Exactly. But so whoever said ethnic field recording was, you know, being a little dumb and a little racist. But Zappa said, we're going to come and record all this in this house.
That on paper sounds cool, right? It does sound cool. Oh, yeah.
But you have to be a kind of cruel person to think that this is what we'll do in the face of that actual situation.
Sure. Yeah.
So Zappa came out to the house with an engineer, and they recorded some stuff like overdubs, backing tracks. And you hear that throughout the record, like, you know, dappled in. One of the great things about Trout Mask Replica for me is that it is a crazy record, but also it makes it explicit that it is a record. There's spoken bits where people are, talking about the actual recording process. There's Beefheart talking about the composition of a song. There's mistakes that are left in. And it's just
what you got to do when you record it in 4 hours.
Yeah, right. Well, this is even like you hear Zappa say, okay, you ready? Yeah. Let's go. And that's the blimp, right? And, you know, the stuff that you would cut out of the tape normally at the beginning and end is left on.
People will say this later, people who are much smarter than I am about the history of music, but this is punk before punk. The way that they were approaching this, the ethos of the approach to the recording.
Super DIY, and also finding what it meant in the process of recording it differently than the standard recording. Mm-hmm. But Beefheart also did not like that. He thought that Zappa was just trying to save money, which he might have been, and then insisted on a professional studio. Zappa said this about Beefheart. It was impossible to tell him why things should be such and such a way. It seemed to me that if he was going to create a unique object, that the best thing for me to do was to keep my mouth shut as much as possible and just let him do whatever he wanted to do, whether I thought it was wrong or not.
Now, you know more than I do, and I don't really want to go through this track by track, but my understanding is that at least two of the tracks that were recorded at the house made it onto the final record, right?
Yeah. And I'm sure that despite all the talk about there's instrumental tracks that were all recorded at once, there were bits and pieces that Zappa assembled, you know, from other moments, and probably the actual field recordings from the house. And, you know, there's a couple acapella tunes and then all of those little interstitial bits that are grabbed. So
this is sort of over my head too, but I'm trying to imagine how they did the tape manipulation that they did on this record in under 4 hours. Cause that would have been an incredibly time consuming process at that time, given the technology that was available to them.
So you mean like doing live tape manipulation while they're playing?
Yeah, which is how it's described, that they like they were recording stuff live and then playing it back and then splicing tape together.
Huh.
I don't know. Maybe it's like I said, it's over my head. But like my experience doing that kind of tape manipulation was that it was like hard, arduous work.
Yeah. And it was made incredibly difficult by Beefheart just being Beefheart. After the instrumental tracks were recorded, in order to do his vocals as an overdub on each of the songs, Beefheart had to go into the studio and they would play the songs back. He would listen and he would sing over them, right? Like you would do normally, except he didn't do it like that. He refused to wear the headphones and sang to the noises that were coming into the room from the control room.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which sounds like the most contrary sort of, you know, obstinate refusal to do things the way that they can best be done.
Well, he has a quote about this, Charlie. He says,
you go ahead
that's
and read it,
what they...
I can't read that.
he when he was asked about why he recorded it this way, he said, well, that's what they do before a commando raid, isn't it? So you can see like his sort of MO was like anytime he was asked a question about the process, he would answer it with a sort of sarcastic, impish, you know, quip. And then back up and be like, now I'm going to turn this into a performance piece, like yeah. My answer to the interview question.
Yeah, he would say anything to anybody. He, in a Rolling Stone interview, said that no one ever took drugs, that he taught Harkle Road and Mark Boston how to play guitar, that he composed and arranged everything and taught it to the band, all of which has been sort of knocked out since. He even said that he wrote all the songs on the album in a single 8-hour session. And automatically, you know, it's wrong because band members said Moonlight on Vermont and Sugar and Spikes were written in 67, but then Veterans Day Poppy was written in 68. I believe that Beefheart is talking about, you know, at some point he inflicted upon John French for 8 hours improvisation over all of his lyrics, or he's saying that he wrote all the lyrics for the record in 8 hours, and then those went into the pipeline to be turned into songs.
Yeah, I mean, the premise of how this record was made sounds like it could have been a cool project if this guy's ego wasn't in the room. That, like, there's... the idea of a band going to a house for 8 months, writing and practicing all of these songs together... And in the compositional method that this band did, which we'll get into, all the like polyrhythmic shit.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. And then going into a studio and in 1 week, just like, boom, banging it out. Like, that's fascinating. But then it's the stuff that happened afterward. Well, also in the house, like him treating everybody so horribly. And then afterward being like, oh, they're all useless. I did everything.
Yeah. Beefheart said that the way he wanted the record to sound was similar to a splicing exercise that Gary Marker, who is a recording engineer, played for him. Gary Marker would practice his audio splicing by combining sections of various recordings so that they would join smoothly and maintain a consistent beat despite being from different sources. And Beefheart said, that's what I want.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not... in any, you know, that's not like a bad thing.
No, you know,
that,
but it's
that it, plus the composition style seems like it would create a really interesting record.
Yep.
And along with that, like remix style, also all of the free jazz influence that Beefheart was, you know, putting into his work. Like this is a guy who would play saxophone, not knowing how to play saxophone because he liked how Ornette Coleman sounded. He used the piano kind of on purpose. He didn't play piano, so he just worked on finding rhythms or melodies that he liked. And then when he finally got what he wanted, he would just kind of stick on that. And then John French would have to transcribe those patterns and take those fragments back to the band and arrange them.
French has also said that 3/4 of the songs were composed at the piano. That's how, like, a huge bulk of this record was done with that methodology, where basically you've got Beefheart just sitting at the piano, banging on notes, French sitting there trying to transcribe it into something that he can then take to the other members.
How were the other quarter of the songs composed, Chris?
Dear God. The rest mostly consisted of parts that were whistled by Van Vliet. In a few cases, part of the song was composed at the piano while other parts were whistled. Sure. I feel like this is the kind of stuff, though, like when I first heard Beefheart and people were excited about it in my age bracket, and they'd be like, man, this is so amazing. Listen to this. Listen to his voice. Listen to the sounds. He fucking whistled this whole thing, man. Isn't that so cool? And now, like, I hear it and I'm like, God, this guy was so difficult. Like, I can't imagine.
I do want to hear the record that French hypothesizes that if they'd had a week to record and do extra takes, I mean, that sounds like it would be good.
Yeah, it sounds very interesting.
And reminding myself that, you know, the recording process was a little weird. Let's move into the sort of producer and label kind of part of the production.
Yeah.
So Beefheart and his Magic Band had already recorded a couple records. They had a single that was really popular, a cover of Bo Diddley's Diddy Wah Diddy. That was a single that A&M Records thought would hit. And it didn't. And then Buddha Records released 1967's Safe as Milk. But then, as they say in this bio that we found, when Buddha Records began specializing in bubblegum pop, Captain Beefheart felt he had no place, and the band again found themselves without a record label. And then in 67 and 68, before they really got deep into Trout Mask Replica stuff, they recorded sessions that would become Strictly Personal and Mirror Man. They didn't know if any of this stuff would ever be released. And finally, that's when Beefheart reached out to Zappa, who was, you know, getting bigger and bigger all the time, and said, will you help me record an album that I can just do what I want? And Zappa said, yes, which is weird, because as Chris Ingles says in Pop Matters, so how does a notorious control freak like Frank Zappa produce an album by a character as colorful as Beefheart? By allowing Beefheart to do what he wanted. This is where Zappa seems to indulge Beefheart like a relative, as opposed to run Beefheart like a...
He was more hands-off than he would have been with another project. Yeah.
Someone is quoted in the Chris Ingles piece as saying, Zappa provides an atmosphere on the record. The collage techniques of editing, the use of his own voice, which you hear at various crucial junctures, the use of segues. This was a sort of workplace for Zappa, a laboratory for what some of his later records would become.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about the label that Zappa owned and that this was released on. It's called Straight Records. Apparently he had two different labels, Straight and Bizarre, but Straight was formed in 1969, and the idea was that it would distribute productions and, quote, discoveries of Frank Zappa and his business manager, Herb Cohen.
So I have to say, I guess there are times when I find Zappa funny.
Yeah.
Having Straight Records and Bizarre Records as your two labels, okay.
What they did, though, like, it sounds like, oh, it was an indie label, right? No. They would produce the recordings, and then they would be manufactured and distributed by major companies in the US and the UK. So in the US, it was Warner Brothers. In the UK, it was CBS Records. So I don't know about your experience with this, but I could not get a hold of this digitally. I had to listen to a rip of it on YouTube. Because I went to go listen to it on like my Google subscription and it wasn't there. Yeah. This speaks to that. So rumors have apparently been made that since the early 1990s, the ownership of some of the Straight recordings has become unclear, and it may have prevented further reissues of some of this material of coming out. I don't know what the lineage is with this record, but there are plenty of copies of Trout Mask Replica floating around that you can
get. All over the place.
But I think the streaming rights are confused.
Yeah. Just recently, Jack White and Third Man Records did another re-release of Trout Mask Replica on vinyl.
Oh, okay.
I think that at the time these contracts were signed, everything about physical media was pretty clear.
Yeah.
And then when you got into digital... Like, this is a thing that people talk about. The contracts that didn't talk about digital or all forms or whatever like that, suddenly made streaming rights either hard to get mm-hmm. or easy to steal.
I don't know about like what it's like on Spotify or other platforms, but on the Google platform, almost everything else by them is there, but Trout Mask is not.
Yeah. And I must confess, I have a vinyl reissue of Trout Mask Replica. Not Sundazed, but another one of those, like, we buy the rights to old records and then put them on 180 gram vinyl at half speed.
That's one of the things they speak about here, is about how some of these have been reissued on 180 gram, but they're not available. Oh, they have been made available on the iTunes store. Okay, but not necessarily on all the other platforms.
Trout Mask is very particular that it doesn't seem to have a coherent re-release, except that over and over again, you can always get a vinyl.
Right, right. Yeah, because that's like a license to print money, basically. You know, like, because every generation is going to have like a group of record nerds who are like, oh, I just discovered this. And they're going to go out and spend the whatever, $30 on the reissue.
Yeah. If you go onto iTunes, you cannot find the record, but you can find the audiobook of the 33 and a third book about Trout Mask Replica.
Okay. You want to take a break? And then when we come back, we can talk about how this thing was actually received, both financially and critically, and then get into the more esoteric compositional stuff that really relates to the themes of why so many people both love and hate this record.
Is that a rhetorical question?
You can say yes or no. Either way, we're going to do it. Hey, everybody. This is another reminder that we have decided that after 4 full years, we're going to retire Super Context in May of the year 2020. We will be continuing our less formal mini-sode conversations. Once a month, we're going to do those, and they're going to be a reward for people who still contribute to our Patreon campaign.
Now, you might be asking, why would I keep contributing to Super Context after you all stop regular production? Well, we want to keep our archive up online, and we wanted to keep it free. And that costs a little bit of money, a lot less than regular production does.
So anybody who pledges a dollar or up can also do these things. They can ask us questions that we will answer in those minisodes. They'll have access to all of those minisodes, as well as everything we've done in the past. Every Super Context episode, every past mini episode, and every one of our Super King Context episodes.
We are headed like a giant tractor trailer with a goblin face on the front of it towards the final Super King Context.
All of our patrons are saying, we made you. We made you.
We're going to finish off with Maximum Overdrive. It's going to be great.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Now, for the next 5 months, we're going to continue business as usual, which means that your support on Patreon helps us do things like pay for our hosting fees, cover our media artifact expenses, and continue to update our recording setup for better production.
Yeah, we've got to replace those pop filters.
And I just use the money to buy tacks to keep up the soundproofing tiles in my studio.
God, that's hilarious. I've never thought to itemize attaching this stuff.
The Patreon will continue to be important for the next couple of months, but when we cease production of our regular episodes, the support will keep the public RSS feed up and going so anyone can listen and discover the show the same way that you might have done.
So you can check us out on patreon.com/supercontext. See what's available now, what will be available in the future, and what you can get while we head towards retirement. We're not going to slow down, though. We're just going to do this until we're done. Something that we give everyone who is a patron is a personal thank you, unless they say, please don't thank me. So this is where we do that.
So let's start with our newest patrons, Alice Florence and Gregory C. Giordano.
Thank you so much for joining this crew, including thank yous to Alex Laird, Ambrose Allen, Amit Doshi, Andy Riggs, B.B. Schwells, Bennett Callahan, Beth Barnett, Billy Whitehouse, Brian Chovanich, Caroline Zoids, Chris Marlton, and Cliff Landis.
Thank you also to Coco, Dave Jordan, Dave Wachter, Eilish Phillips, Elijah Tilstra, Evan Mapstone, Fred Rasko, Ira James Udiskin, and Jason Puckett.
Thank you to Jess Staten, Joseph Alejo, Juan Patton, Junta/Cult, Calvin Ellis, Carmela Padovich, Kate Sharon, Kevin Wetter, Christian Hirvala, Lee Fowler, Liliana Gill, Lokesh Dakar, Luigi Oswego, Melinda Hale, and Miriam Meany.
Thank you also to Misha Moon, Nathan Weatherford, Nick Sage, Patrick Malka, Pete Bow, Philip, R.M. Rhodes, the podcast Rain It In Matt and Rachel, Rob Sloan, Robert Neguesco, Roman Marichek, and Ron Bilodeau.
Thank you to Ross Llewellyn, Ryan O'Neill, Sari Nichols, Simon Workman, Tara Meshack, Thomas Tremberger, Veal Height, and Whitney Buchanan.
To join these hallowed, hallowed names in the hallowed halls of Super Context history, go ahead and follow us at patreon.com/supercontext. Okay, we're back. So I think most of you know where this is going. incredibly difficult esoteric record released in the late 60s. Did not sell well in the United States. It turned out that was not what people were looking for.
Yeah, it was on the United Kingdom charts for a week. It hit number 21 over there. Mostly, Trout Mask Replica was received at the time by a bunch of people who prophesized its eventual acceptance and influence.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't have the numbers in front of us, but we just mentioned talking about all the different label and rights stuff. I mean, clearly this record's been successful enough that people are reissuing it over and over and over again in different formats.
Yeah. People as famous and important as John Peel and Lester Bangs have talked about Trout Mask Replica and its importance. John Peel said, "If there has been anything in the history of popular music which could be described as a work of art in a way that people who are involved in other areas of art would understand, then Trout Mask Replica is probably that work." And Lester Bangs said, "It was not even ahead of its time in 1969. Then and now, it stands outside time, trends, fads, hypes, the rise and fall of whole genres, eclectic as walking Christmas trees, constituting a genre unto itself. Truly a musical monolith, if there ever was one."
We actually have the entire All Music review by Steve Huey here as well, but this is a quote from it. He said that it's stunningly imaginative and its influence was, quote, "felt more in spirit than in direct copycatting, as a catalyst rather than a literal musical starting point. However, its inspiring reimagining of what was possible in a rock context laid the groundwork for countless experiments in rock surrealism to follow, especially during the punk new wave era."
Now, we can use some of the writing from All Music to lay out in a very clinical way what it is about this record, and also give a sense of how someone who's not trying to be all cool about it might talk about the record. "It's highly unconventional musical style, which includes polyrhythm, multi-octave vocals, and polytonality, continues to polarize audiences and has given the album a reputation as one of the most challenging recordings in the 20th century musical canon."
Let me ask you a question, Charlie. Do you know a single female person who enjoys this record?
Yes.
You do? Okay.
I do.
I have never met someone who is not male, that when you play this record for them, that they're like, "Oh, cool." They're almost always like, "Yeah, great," after 5 minutes.
It does seem to lean into that kind of, music nerd, insufferable music snob kind of territory. But I also know through interviews that PJ Harvey really likes this record.
That makes sense. Yeah.
And when I played it for my wife, she did not stop it.
Okay.
And she stayed in it with me and says that she likes it. She doesn't ask for me to put it back on.
Kind of the same way that you like Zoe's Remarkable Playlist or whatever that's called.
Oh, no. I looked her in the eye and said, this television show is shit. She said, "It's really interesting to listen to the Captain Beefheart."
Oh, okay. My wife, like, I've played Dock at the Radar Station a bunch of times, and so she will kind of like joke about lyrics from that and stuff, but she doesn't enjoy it. And everyone I've ever met who really enjoys this record is a dude.
Yeah. I think that we kind of buried a thing that's important about this record too. The other Captain Beefheart records with His Magic Band or The Magic Band or just Captain Beefheart records do not sound like this.
Yeah, I find that there's like varying levels of difficulty, I guess, with the like Beefheart records, depending on where and when they are in time, I guess, in relation to this record. But like I said to you when we were going to do this, my favorite one is Dock at the Radar Station. And I think it's because it leans more into more conventional rhythms. And it's still quirky and something that most people would be like, what the fuck is this? But it's also catchy.
There you go. Other Beefheart records are quirky and catchy.
Yeah.
Trout Mask Replica is hard to listen to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So that subsequently, and this is not us, this is this is the reviews. Many people say because it's so unconventional, it just alienates new listeners. I kept thinking to myself, like, if I played this record for my sister, you know, like, what would her reaction be? She's sort of my litmus test for stuff like this. And she'd probably laugh for a couple minutes and then be like, okay, I don't need to listen to this anymore.
It's on best of lists. Rolling Stone put it on the 500 greatest albums of all time at number 60. Colin Larkin has it in the all-time top 1,000 albums, voted in as number 50. It is more revered, I think, publicly than any other Beefheart record, even though it's very likely that most people enjoy another Beefheart record more.
Yeah, I mean, I can say from doing the research, the obituaries for Van Vliet specifically shot right at this record. They mentioned, you know, all of Captain Beefheart as having a discography, but they included an entire paragraph about Trout Mask Replica.
Yeah. And this is the only Beefheart record that was inducted into the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry.
So far.
It was in 2010.
Yeah.
So far. I would bet some money that in my lifetime there won't be another one.
You'd be surprised at some of the stuff, though. You know, when I read that, I was like, yeah, I don't know. That's not that big of a deal. Like, I've been down to the LOC. There's some stuff that's like, yeah, in the archive.
It's not about quality. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in the recording registry, I assume, because of the way it has been talked about, the way it has been critically examined. And I don't think that there's going to be some sudden revelation that, oh, holy cow, Clear Spot really, truly is an artistic statement that we didn't understand before.
Oh, yeah, maybe. That could be true. That there, this is sort of like, all right, we've given Beefheart his due. Let's move on.
Now, in our standard super context run of topics,
yeah,
we also talk about representation and regulation for each media artifact. Now, with representation, it's very clear that this is a personal document when it comes to the lyrics. Beefheart says I a lot. Beefheart goes up and down and all around topics. He does not seem to really be doing anything besides weaving his own experience of the world through surrealistic techniques.
Yeah.
To then become faux blues lyrics for these extraordinary songs.
Yeah, the representation thing is kind of tough with this record because I don't know the exact ethnicities or how all the different band members identify, you know, sexually or gender wise. But it seems, like I said earlier, it seems pretty white and male focused, both from his perspective, but also from an audience perspective.
Yeah.
I tried imagining what, like, if I brought this to some black friends who were also creators and played this for them, like I tried to imagine like what their reaction would be, and it just immediately came to me that like most people would be like, boy, this is some white people shit, like only white people would do this, you know.
So that leads us into talking about the sort of themes present in the record and the identity that it posits. And really, it's what does liking the record or appreciating the record kind of posit as an identity?
Yeah, and I think that, like, this is a record where you can get real navel-gazy very quickly about the music theory behind it. But what we're more interested in are what are the sort of larger qualitative themes, both that Beefheart was trying to communicate to the world, but also that the world has taken from this record.
Yeah. And you mentioned punk earlier.
Yeah.
And this does seem to be right at the moment, the precipice of punk rock, especially the idea of the kind of theatricality of cabaret music moving into the poetry, the beat poetry, and turning into punk rock in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, John Lydon of the Sex Pistols, he said that Trout Mask Replica was anti-music in the most interesting and insane way, and a confirmation that there was room for everything if you were frustrated by the rules in pop music.
That is one of the most insightful things that I've ever heard come out of Johnny Rotten's mouth. So I'll take it.
No. John Lydon said that.
Oh.
Johnny Rotten is a different person.
Chris Ingles from Pop Matters goes on to say that if you look at these Beefheart records, they influenced a lot of the quote punk rock flavor of the era. And Beefheart himself apparently treated the punk genre with a lot of disdain. My favorite Beefheart song is about this, Ashtray Heart. And he thought that he was being ripped off by punk rock. And he also felt that they were appropriating his stuff, but they weren't acknowledging his influence, which is, again, hilarious in retrospect when you realize, like, it was actually the influence of the five other people that played on this record.
Yeah, and I think we need to read at least the beginning of Ashtray Heart. Here are the lyrics. You used me like an ashtray heart, case of the punks right from the start. I feel like a glass shrimp in a pink panty with a saccharine chaperone making invalids out of supermen. Call on a shrink and pick you up in a girdle. You used me like an ashtray heart.
Yeah, there you go. Case of the punks right from the start. So he felt like he wasn't getting the benefit of a crossover audience from punks, and he was bitter about it. So I don't know, which is kind of interesting to me because a lot of my punk friends love this stuff and like go back and reference it. I would imagine that a lot of like, who knows how the royalty money was distributed in his latter years, but like right. A lot of the latter year attention that this thing got was because of punk.
Well, you know, no one ever mentioned in the articles I can remember about like the Talking Heads, television, the Ramones saying, and Beefheart, clearly a progenitor of this style. Like he just didn't get
Burn
the kind
comes
of
up in here a little bit, but yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Burn does, and Peru Abu.
And even, yeah, John Lydon said that he liked him, but the popular narrative wasn't, you know. I don't think people were saying, oh, yeah, punk rock, you know, they listened to Beefheart.
We'll also remember, like, Ashtray Heart came out in, like, what, 1980? And it was, like, 1993 when Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love were telling Rolling Stone that they were conceiving a baby to this record. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
So it's described by folks in the same way that Ian MacKaye says punk operates now, you know, as a methodology and an ethos. A take no prisoners attitude. We quoted Keneally earlier. Keneally says he was completely unashamed, Beefheart was, to be exactly himself and possessed the will to do precisely what he wanted and not give a shit about what a record label might think of it. And that doesn't connect exactly superficially to punk rock. And it doesn't sort of say, oh yeah, you know, three chords and a guitar, you can just nail it. But that is exactly what people wanted to be if they were sort of diving into punk rock.
What's kind of fascinating about it is like he had that what we now call punk rock approach to creating art, in that he was like a very undisciplined amateur performer. But rather than surround himself with other undisciplined amateur performers, he went to people who knew what they were doing.
Right.
And tried to explain to them, you know, do this thing that I have in my head, which is quite different, you know, from, say, the Ramones.
Yeah. A huge step to Trout Mask Replica being understood, I guess, properly would be if it had been credited to a band, not yeah. Captain Beefheart and Possessive, his magic band.
Yeah. So, all right, let's get a little bit into the weeds on this compositional stuff. There are two, quote, musicologists who have commented ad nauseum about this record. The first is Samuel Andreyev, and the second is Susan Rogers. We'll have a link to these in the notes. There's a separate video of Samuel Andreyev talking for 30 minutes about the first song on this record and breaking it down.
Then there's really enjoy that video. That makes me very happy. I know a lot of people don't like it.
I don't want to spend 30 minutes talking about a 2-minute song. No thanks. I will rather take the 10-minute condensed version about the entire album that Vox produced. It was produced by Estelle Caswell at Vox. And basically, this is what they get. So Andreyev and Susan Rogers say, this record melds blues and free jazz, but it also deconstructed rock band instrumentation, okay? So let me see if I can get this right. The drums and the bass weren't actually locking down rhythms in the songs the way that they traditionally do in rock music. They were playing independent music. And one thing they made a lot of hay about, which I was kind of confused by, where they're like, dude, the bass player's playing chords. Can you believe it? And I'm like, yeah, I can believe it. Like, I've heard Tool before, you know, or like whatever.
Again, you're listening to this in the post Trout Mask Replica world, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So then they also point out that the rhythm and the lead guitar were playing two different time signatures, and neither of their time signatures were traditional 4-4 rhythms. Then you add the brass instruments on top of it, which is just like, as you mentioned, he doesn't know how to play saxophone, so it's just squawking.
But he does play it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the band members themselves point out he didn't know how to play bass or guitar. Really, let's be honest, he didn't seem to know how to play anything except for his vocals. And a lot of it was improvisational. This sentence may make more sense to you. I've never heard this term before until doing this research. Only jazzbos dig on learning polyrhythms. What's a jazzbo? Well, a bro who's into jazz?
You already said it. Yeah. You know, it seems like most of the people who really dig this record are white dudes.
Okay. That's what a jazzbo is.
I have never heard jazzbo before.
Okay.
My assumption is that, that's, you know, a jazz head, someone who's really into jazz, and maybe even sort of a derogatory term.
Yeah.
However, Chris, in anticipation of this question, I asked the internet.
Uh-oh.
And the internet says that it's actually more like a person who's into jazz, rightfully so.
Huh, okay.
A musician or enthusiast, a connoisseur, DJ, or aficionado, especially an older man. Term may have originated with Al Collins, whose nickname was Jazzbo, spelled like Beaux Arts. So okay. Jazzbo.
Hmm. All right. Well, this is from Ted Mills at Open Culture. He says, there's so many other reasons beyond the polyrhythms to appreciate Trout Mask Replica. For one, it's the proud tradition of European surrealism, but it also comes from a particular, quote, old, weird America that produced some of our most brilliant nutcases. Maybe this is what I'm talking about when I'm saying, like, this guy reminds me of S. Clay Wilson or of Rocky Erickson.
Well, this is the piece that makes me think of Gravity's Rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the edge of America during the Cultural Revolution, you know, and someone who had complete freedom being a nutbag.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonder, it would be a whole nother episode to dissect why we don't have those kinds of nutbags anymore and if it's a good thing or not.
I'm sure we have them. It's just so much easier to sell people who are not crazy like that.
There's also like a lot more of a signal to noise ratio right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is like when Patton Oswalt talks about open mic nights. Do you remember from his first record, or maybe from the full uncut performance that turned into his first record? But he said, you go to enough open mic nights, you will get the crazy people who come in who can remind you that you're nowhere near the edge. You know?
Yeah.
And he's like, if I can remember correctly, he says, oh yeah, man, I'm edgy. I'm edgy as fuck. I'm the next Bill Hicks. I'm really challenging audiences. And then somebody walks in and says, Jesus has a ghost penis that lives in your cereal. And you're like, oh, I'm nowhere near the edge.
Right. Yeah. 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 That's fair. Let's go back to Estelle Caswell, because I found that she really did a good job of boiling this all down to something comprehensible.
Yeah.
She says this record has been compared to the musical equivalent of listening to barbed wire, and that the New York Times once said that Captain Beefheart's voice makes, quote, Tom Waits sound like Julie Andrews.
Do you know why that's funny?
No.
Because Tom Waits, when he started, he was kind of a beat poet performer,
okay,
kind of a crooner. You know, he's like doing, what did he say? He said, I liked Bing Crosby more than Blue Cheer, and that's how I ended up doing what I did.
Gotcha.
And the story is that his wife gave him a copy of Trout Mask Replica, and that's why there was the radical shift in his musical output from Heart Attack and Vine on.
Okay. Okay. So it's the other way around. Waits was influenced by Beefheart.
Yeah. And Waits's voice does sound very nice when he's not mimicking Captain Beefheart on Swordfish Trombones, which is a clear reference to the record.
But I still want to tell my very, very funny joke, which is
tell me your joke.
There should be a reenactment, a remake of The Sound of Music starring Tom Waits as the nanny taking care of the children in World War II Germany. Or I guess they're in Austria.
Did you know that in the business of nanny placement, they call a male nanny a manny? And that is an actual industry term?
I believe you, because your wife is a professional nanny and runs a nanny company.
Yeah.
But
I would have thought that was bullshit, but it turns out, yeah,
weird.
They're mannies.
All right. Sure. Yeah. Give me some Tom Waits manny action. Anyways, let's get back to this. Andreev, who's the composer who goes really deep into this, he says Frownland, which is the first song on the record, is purposely supposed to plunge you into a land of absolute strangeness. So it's like a challenge, basically. Like, they put the most difficult piece right up front at first to be like...
He counts 21 different little riffs that are working on, with, and against each other.
In his own video, Andreev says he doesn't like it when critics use emotional descriptors because it doesn't help to get at what is going on with the composition on this record. This is something that I feel like you and I have probably harped on before when we've talked about the musical criticism press.
Well, I also have to cop to, I am an emotional descriptor using motherfucker like all the time. So
we've established that you use temperature metaphors.
That's true. That's true. Well, you know, some people run hot, Chris.
Either that or moisture descriptors.
Moving on. Susan Rogers, who is one of our favorites on the show because she was Prince's engineer and she produced that David Byrne record.
Mm-hmm.
She says that the band splices naive impulses, meaning Beefheart's untrained musicianship, into structure. And made a record that sounds almost completely improvised, even though it's rehearsed down to every single detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that gets to the heart of like why this is technically different from DIY punk, right? In that, like, he may be a quote naive musician, but they are trained, practiced musicians taking it and regurgitating it.
Yeah. And that's a very particular term in like art history or art theory. The sentimental artist versus the naive artist. Mm-hmm. Sentimental being someone who has trained in a technique, a history, a genre, and works within that tradition, versus naive, who is driven, I think the quote is, driven to create purely to create.
Which I believe, we didn't use that terminology, but that seems to strike a chord with what we talked about in the Basquiat episode and the way that Basquiat and his contemporaries were approaching painting.
Would you like to give Susan Rogers the last word of the podcast?
Yeah, she. This is also in the video. They interview her and she says, look, this record is not contrarian for the sake of being contrarian. What it actually is it's artistic for the sake of being original, which is, I think, is a nice quote. However, I do want to use this as an opportunity to kind of circle back to one of my original points.
Yeah.
Susan Rogers and Andreev, while they say very interesting stuff about composition and the language of describing how music works that helps us understand this record, neither of them in these interviews seem to address the like cult-like negative conditions that this was produced under. And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I can't help, like, once I've learned this information, I can't help but keep coming back to that. Like, I don't think I'll ever listen to this record the same way again. I don't think I'll hear it and be giddy, you know. I think I'm going to hear, like, oh my god, there's so much tension going on with this, and one guy threw up on his lawn just thinking about making this record. The other guy said that he was afraid when people raised their hand to him afterwards, you know? So there's a little bit of sadness, I think, that goes along with learning about how this was all made.
I can totally understand that. But I think that you are actually getting the most interesting experience of the record possible by being able to hear it, I guess, clean at first. Hearing it as a record that is weird and challenging and pushy and makes you think of other work out there in the world. And then finding out that it's actually a portrait of a working process that is almost the exact opposite of how it was sold at first.
You've been listening to Super Context, a podcast autopsy of media.
How it's made and how it informs our everyday culture.
Our theme music is Human Factor by Mile Marker.
And right now you're listening to Drive Fast by Three Chain Links.
Show notes and all our past episodes are available at supercontextpodcast.libsyn.com.
You can email the show at supercontextpodcast@gmail.com to tell us what you like, what you don't like, and to suggest topics for future shows.
And I'm available on Twitter as @ChristianSager.
And I'm there @BennettRadio. Two N's, two T's.